Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Rhymer Hood by Gregory Frost, narrated by Alex Wyndham. Part 1. The Wood Woes. 1. Thieves. There was something off about the prelate. Even Little John sensed it. Clothed in simple sackcloth, the bishop waddled south along the King's Great Way through Sherwood, the only obvious item of value being the ivory-topped crozier he handled like a walking stick as he approached the huge split oak tree behind which John and his companions hid. Yet if he was just a journeying palmer, why was he accompanied by two knights dressed as if fresh from a crusade in Red Cross-adorned surcoats? Knights Templar? What did he have worth stealing? Robert Hodd had to be wondering the same thing. In front of John, lean and scruffy, Hodd leaned on his quarterstaff. John, and behind him, the third member of their little band, the rabbity-faced Much the Miller's boy, watched the trio approach over his shoulder. In the depths of the woods, their clothes of green with red trim rendered them nearly invisible. The knights wore quilted gambesons beneath deep brown brigandines, presumably plated, although at this distance it was hard to tell, they might just be thick leather. Either way, the two layers would probably stop an arrow, certainly at the distance Hodd's team preferred to work. That meant close fighting if the prelate chose to be feisty, and only Hodd had brought his quarterstaff. John and Much only had their bows. At least the knights didn't sport fauchards or crossbows. Just flat-topped steel pot helms with gold crosspiece decorations on the front protecting their heads and arming swords at their hips.
"What do you think, John?" Hodd muttered. "Something in that satchel."
The prelate carried a small satchel on a baldric slung over one shoulder. It might have contained his more elaborate dalmatic or folded cape, but not much more than one of those. Still, hardly calls for the presence of the knights. Granted, there were other outlaws lurking in the high forest between the River Aire and Nottingham. Hodd's band knew them all. John and he only forayed into Sherwood for quick robberies, after which they headed right back to Barnsdale Wood, where the sheriff or the king's men were less likely to pursue, much less find them. Even the occasional deer they slew they carried off to Barnsdale, leaving no trace that they'd trespassed in the king's preserve. Life was safer that way. The prelate drew nearer. Little John read Hodd's profile. He was chewing on the tip of his brown beard. John knew he was reconsidering. Robbing a priest, even an unaccompanied one, could bring all kinds of trouble. The church simply had no sense of humor. And this was peculiar. Then the prelate's sackcloth shawl flapped open, and Little John saw two flashes of color beneath it. He remarked,
"He's got him a king's ransom on that cincture round his middle. Look at them sparklers, Robbie."
He pointed. The sackcloth obligingly flopped open with his next step, and a dangling section of knotted silk cincture swung into view. It flickered red and green where the sunlight caught it. Small jewels in settings had been worked into the wide rope. Hodd had to appreciate that for all his pretense of poverty, the prelate had not been able to deny himself one tiny act of vanity. Or maybe it was the only cincture he owned. Of some value, certainly. But it did not explain the need for the company of two knights. The prelate and his guards were drawing even with the split oak. John said,
"Well?"
He looked to Robert Hodd for a sign. Hodd turned his head and started to speak, but he'd barely breathed,
"We should."
Before naive Much, as he had done successfully a dozen times before, strode swiftly out from behind the tree. Hodd hissed his name and tried to reach around Little John to grab him, but it was too late. Much scrambled right up into the road ahead of the travellers, his bow knocked, and though pointed at no one, an obvious threat.
John muttered, "Come on, Robbie, put down your staff and grab your bow."
Much called,
"Good sirs,"
as he blocked the prelate's way.
"Forgive me, but I'm obliged to ask for some charity from the clergy, for my friends and me."
He gave a slight nod, and the knights as one turned to behold Robert Hodd and Little John step out from behind the broad tree and circle onto the road behind them. Bows likewise knocked, though not aimed at anyone in particular yet. Hodd was cursing under his breath that this was a terrible idea.
"Merciful God!" exclaimed the prelate. "How dare you threaten to rob a poor man of the church such as myself, sirrah?"
Not so poor as to waddle alone from Wentbridge, secure in the knowing that you carry nothing of interest to the likes of us,
Much replied. Hogg gave his head a small shake at that. Even little John recognised the lad's phrasing hardly passed muster. Hogg took a step forward to wrest control of this situation.
A quick look in the satchel is all we need,
he called,
and then you can continue on thy way.
The prelate turned about.
Show you that I will not rob Hogg,
he replied. He beamed triumphantly.
Oh, I know your name, Cutpurse. It is not a name to be proud of. It is also, in fact, not my name, good Metropolitan, so you may use it as you like.
He held the bow to the side, one finger hooked over the arrow, and extended the other arm as if in friendly gesture. Worry poured off him like heat.
Surely a mere nib in sight cannot harm.
The knights said nothing, but one of them and the prelate turned to face Much, while the other continued to stare at little John and Hogg without moving. A dull ache vibrated in John's head, and he saw Hogg wince as if the same pain plagued him. The facing knight drew his arming sword. The blade flashed with sunlight in rainbow colours like that of no steel John had ever beheld. Hogg withdrew his friendly gesture and gripped his bow again. Little John was certain now that they should have let this group pass by. The knights were sinister in some way he could not pinpoint. The one facing Much had drawn his blade too. It glinted with its similar sheen. If he hadn't been fixated upon it, he wouldn't have seen what happened next, though it was as if he didn't see it at all, but only its effect. The length of the blade seemed to strike like a snake, plunging straight through Much. The lad went up on his tiptoes, his mouth opened in a gasp, while the sword was merely an arming sword again, held at the knight's side, although now coated with blood that looked to be vanishing, as if into the blade. Hogg called out Much's name, but Much did not seem to hear, instead stumbling forward and back, eyes pleading helplessly with him and John. Then he collapsed. In that instant, little John reached over, grabbed Hogg by the quiver strap, and yanked him aside, just as the second knight's blade sprang the distance. He wasn't quite quick enough. The impossible blade slashed straight through Hod's side instead of his middle, gone again so fast it all seemed an illusion. The blade extended from the knight's hand like a normal sword, and now it too was soaking up the blood that stained it. Hod's blood. Little John let go of him, aimed and shot the prelate in the back. The jolt flung the mitre from the priest's head, and he staggered in a circle, clutching at the arrow driven through him. Both knights turned to him. The prelate wheezed, raised an arm as if about to bless or curse Hogg. Then a weird mist of red blood burst through his sackcloth cloak, and his face seemed to ooze from his head. John took this in as he charged the nearest knight before the fellow could direct his magical blade again. He hammered a fist against the crusader's pot helm hard as he could, and an unusual thing happened. Instead of falling off, the helmet retreated into the brigandine like a snail drawing into its shell, as if it was a soft guard core and not solid at all. It revealed a long, spiky and coarse grey face surrounded by silvery hair. The knight stumbled and went down on one knee. John stepped past him and grabbed the strap of the satchel from the melting, collapsing corpse of the prelate as the second knight turned from Much's body, sword arm extended. That was when Hod's arrow pierced the knight's wrist and the magical sword fell out of his grasp, otherwise John would have been skewered. The spiky-faced knight started to rise, and John clubbed him down again, a blow that should have shattered his neck. Behind him, Hogg cried,
"Take it! Run, John!"
Little John needed no further urging. He hurled himself into the woods, through the trees on a path they all knew to use. But when he looked back, Hogg wasn't behind him. Two other figures were. If they were the knights, they'd transformed into white-haired, greenish-grey-faced demons, sheathed now in strange black armour that gleamed like steel but hugged them like full-body hauberks. The one in front carried one of the weirdly gleaming swords, the one in back clutched its wrist. Their running was jerky, as if they'd never done it before. Dodging ahead, he dared another glance just as the flashing blade shot forward. He leapt, almost kicking his heels together, and the blade stabbed into the ground beside him, then as quickly snapped back. John picked up his speed and raced away through the forest, into a landscape he knew from a lifetime of thieving and outwitting pursuit. What were these creatures? Devils they must be, guarding a prelate who'd melted. Had he actually witnessed that? He could only hope that Robert Hodd had fled in the other direction and made good his escape, because whatever was in this old satchel he'd snatched, the knights had both come after it. A king's ransom, at the very least, he imagined. It had cost poor Much his life. What had they all blundered into? 2. Fontevraud, 1185. Janet was dying. The tall and imposing Abbess Gilles told Thomas herself, but he knew already, just as he knew there was nothing he could do this time to cure her. Something had been in her lungs for months, and it was getting worse. She was 73 now, a remarkable age. He could still see in her thinner face the woman he remembered. Janet's skin was like moist parchment pulled over her bones, her lips prone to cracks, and her hair gone completely white. Her skinny wrists and arms made him think of birds. But Janet's reaching the end of her life was natural. What was unnatural was his own failure to do the same. Even Morven, their daughter, was older in appearance now than he. Morven resembled Janet as she appeared after his return from Elphian, the same slope to her nose, the same wide jaw. He'd taken care not to unglamour in her presence. He'd been careful with that right from the first. 2 decades earlier, when he'd brought his sister Innes back to Ursel Doon from Cluny, he had looked the part of her younger brother naturally. However, because he was going to have to masquerade as their non-existent relative, Ainsley Ramore of Allwich, for a short time, he'd had to reveal to her how, because of the elves, he could change his appearance. Poor Innes had already long been the victim of elven magic, labelled a madwoman and shut away with the truly mad, initially by the Ivag that had inhabited their father. Damaged by their cruelty, she might be, but mad, she was not, despite that they'd stolen her baby and told her it was dead. How she withstood that loss, she did not know, but she accepted Thomas's power to transform as if it were the most normal thing in the world. She grasped immediately how he must pretend to have aged in order to match his Janet. He had believed the discrepancy was due to the way time ran here versus in Elphian. Janet had waited 20 years for his return, while for him their separation had lasted a handful of months. So he aged himself to match his beloved, to let her forget. Innes took charge of the family estates. He remained nearby at Carden's Keep with Janet, only long enough to determine that the Ivag had gotten his message never to return to old Melrose. For months, none came through the invisible gate there. No fiery green ring appeared near the ruins, and no grotesque grey sleepers lay among the tombs of St. Mary's Abbey. No doubt Ivags were emerging through a gate somewhere to collect their teens, but they weren't invading his territory or harming those who mattered to him any longer. His private war with Nick Nevin was done. Innes continued to oversee the Remore and McGillian lands, while Janet and he divided Carden's holdings, including the keep, between the two Lusk brothers, in return for a promise of semi-annual proceeds from the profits. Finally, he bid Innes farewell. They gathered up their belongings, including Janet's loom, his bows and stonecutter's tools, and headed off for the Abbey of Our Lady of Fontevraud, where their daughter lived. Morven had long since accepted that no one was coming for her, and had taken her vows. She was married to the Lord, devoted to the Abbey, and in particular to the current Abbess, Audeberge de Haute-Bruyère, who'd been in charge now for 15 years, more than half of Morven's life. For the Abbess, and for Sister Marguerite, which was what Morven answered to now, Thomas's elves were plainly demons, and he and Janet had been right to rescue their daughter from such influences. Witchcraft and malevolent spirits were everywhere these days, and hadn't God's knights fought 2 crusades to conquer such dark forces? Knowing next to nothing of any crusades, Thomas could only acquiesce in the Abbess's opinion. Morven had never seen an Ivag. Her only memory of a near encounter was of a voice outside their door the night that Janet had whisked her from their home. While she wanted to believe her parents, her reliance now fell upon the Order of Fontevraud. These strangers might be her parents, but what did that word even mean? The busy abbess signed Sister Marguerite to take Janet and Thomas on a tour of the abbey. Fontevraud was a double monastery, Sister Marguerite explained to them, with monks living on the grounds in the priory of Saint-Jean-de-l'Abbaye and working in support of the nuns, as unusual as that sounded, They all laboured side by side while living separately. Altogether, the community numbered close to 3,000, with far more nuns than monks. She showed them the gardens of healing herbs, of vegetables and fruit trees, the smokehouse, the leper house of Saint-Lazare, and the abbey itself, with its bone-white sculpted capitals.
"Near 100 of them," said Morven.
Thomas replied reflexively,
100 too?
Then apologized for a facility he couldn't control. They wandered the grounds, past a well and a sepulchral chapel being erected where nuns were to be interred. He couldn't help being suspicious at the sound of that, wary of any place where it seemed the dead lay sleeping. Crypts could never be trusted. The abbey was built on a slope, and part of the lower wall surrounding it had collapsed after the spring rains. Thomas noted that as they strolled past. When Morven returned them to Abbess Odeberge, he offered to rebuild the wall where it had fallen in. He and Janet, he explained, had moved into a small house in Chinon nearby so that they could be close to their daughter. He would apply to join whoever was constructing the chapel building as well. The abbess asked if he wasn't past his prime with regards to working in stone. He looked, after all, like an old man of 50 years or more, matching Janet's appearance. It was Janet who spoke up then, to say that her husband knew more about the working of stone than anyone she had ever met, and that the abbess would not regret taking him on.
"You'll be working with monks,"
the abbess said. He replied that he had worked with them before, at the Abbazia di Santa Maria di Lucedio in Italia. The abbess knew of that Cistercian abbey. If anything, its mention suggested he was even older than she'd thought. Nevertheless, she agreed to take him on. By the time Innes died, Abbess Odeberge had also passed on and been replaced by the Abbess Gilles. Because of his masonry skills, Abbess Odeberge had referred Thomas to the seneschal of the Chateau of Chinon, and he had gone to work there for King Henry. Portions of the chateau remained unfinished, and it was often unoccupied in that time, but the work was suspended on numerous occasions while Henry battled his own sons and his queen. Thomas watched the staff and advisers for any hint of Evag habitation, but circumspectly so as not to reveal his own identity. To the household of King Henry, he was simply Tam the Old Mason, whose wife wove lovely shawls and small tapestries and who had a daughter in the abbey nearby. That he could do the work of a much younger man was remarked upon, however, and so he started to do less. Routinely, he feigned exhaustion, a perfect excuse to spend even more time in the company of his wife. She had grown more frail. Janet's hair by now was all white. At her loom, she did not pass the shuttle with anything like the agility of old. Her fingers were long, thin, and knobby, and often seemed to pain her. She and he lived well enough, with money coming from Philip Lusk twice a year to bolster what Thomas earned with his mallets, chisels, and trowels, and she with her loom. Kester Lusk had died, and his son had taken over his role as a tenant-in-chief. But Thomas didn't learn his name until word of Innes's death reached him, and he felt he must go home and settle things. He knew Janet would not come with him. Before he'd even asked, she told him,
"This old niece of mine will never make the journey. You needs must go on your own, Tam."
He didn't like being away from her. Too much of his life had been spent away already. But Innes was gone, and the estate must be settled. In her last letter to him, she had stated that she'd put it about that a cousin of hers was expected, one Thomas Learmonth, thus covering his identity locally. Through her, the unseen Learmonth had already purchased a small cottage in Ercildoune, so no one would be surprised by his arrival. Briefly, he considered cutting open a portal, using the Erdstone of Alpin Waldrop he'd found long ago on the path through Thagglewood, and simply stepping from Chinon to Ercildoune. But worried that such an act would send ripples, alerting the Evags to his whereabouts. They might follow him back home, or worse, arrive here while he was gone. He made sure that Janet was looked after in his absence. Abbess Gilles and Morven would ensure that. So, by horseback and by ship, he returned to Ercildoune, which he'd never intended to see again. There, for the first time in years, he went about without any glamour. After all, he was neither Thomas Remor nor Tavis Lynn anymore. Now he was this new Thomas of his sister's creation. Stopping to give his horse a drink, he studied himself where the water was still. A young man with a short beard and thick dark hair, muscular and handsome. He disbelieved his own eyes. Surely this was more a memory of who he'd once been than a reflection of who he was. This was the term of Janet's dreams. And anyway, it was impossible, wasn't it? At 20 years Janet's junior now, he was nearly 50. Perhaps so long under glamour had a lingering effect, or maybe he hadn't fully thrown it off yet. Perhaps over the next few days he would advance to his proper age. The town of Ursel Doone had doubled in size, in part due to land Innes had gifted it. Their castle had become a manor, surrounded by 19 workers' houses, a small church, fields of barley and oats, and even a small mill of their own operating on the Leader River. Innes had already been buried. She had left him instructions for the parcelling and distribution of the land, lots large and small, naming to whom each should be distributed, and who would handle all of this for her. She had used her influence in order to have the property deemed adjudged a fee simple absolute. As such, it was hers to do with, and now his. But Janet was ill, and so he remained only long enough to see a stone erected at Innes's grave and to visit Philip Lusk, now residing in Carden's Keep, to make one more request of him, that he follow up on Innes's instructions. Philip, near an ancient 60, looked worn down, his hair thin, his teeth nearly gone. There'd been no further business with the elves. So far as he could say, they'd stayed away. But oh, how effectively Thomas was glamouring himself to appear young in his role of Learmonth. Thomas said nothing. But upon his return to Ursel Doone, he paused at the pool on the Teviot, where he'd once watched Janet swim, to look again at his impossible reflection. Who was this staring up at him? Not someone who had known more years of life than old Philip. Philip, whom he should have resembled by now. He all but fled the pool. In the morning he would depart for Tynemouth, but thought to pay a final visit to the Gorse and Hare, which was still a going concern in the same location where he and Alpin Waldrop had once spent the night. He hadn't heard the voice of that ghost in so long that he could no longer remember it accurately. When he'd sailed across the channel with Janet, the spirit of Waldrop had remained behind. In the tavern he confessed to being Innes's cousin, and was asked in turn if he intended to stay on at the manor. He started to explain that no, he was entrusting a local party to execute her will, when his eyelids fluttered and the world seemed to tilt on its side. His head turned ice cold and lightning flashed through it, rattling his skull. The fit was so unexpected he couldn't fight it. As if down a deep well, his own voice echoed to him,
"The Eldritch gone for now return one day for all, when the thorn tree of Ursel Doone on the common here doth fall."
He came to himself on the floor. A crowd of people encircled him, and more were arriving. In the few minutes he'd lain unconscious, word had gone out that Thomas the Rhymer himself was back among them, here in the tavern. He sat up, and they pressed back, as if fearful he might use some mystical force against them, or cast a spell, or otherwise curse them for sussing his identity. He pulled himself up against the nearest table, then gripped onto it to stabilize himself while the world tossed off tiny sparks and tilted itself upright again. Then the taverner stepped forward, put one hand upon his shoulder and said,
"Oh, sir, give us another. Tell us our fortunes. When will that tree fall? Who are the Eldritch?"
"I don't know." He shook his head, confused already as to what it was he'd said.
"I don't know any of it."
He backed away. The crowd parted for him, and he turned and fled out the door, ran down the high street to where his small cottage stood. They called to him all the while to come back and tell them more. He knew what would happen next. Without him, their conflicting recitations would fill the gorse and hare, not just of this riddle, but of many others, most of them things he'd never said. The two simple lines he'd spoken would mutate until people were fighting over what they'd heard. The thorn tree was known to them all, but even he didn't know what the Eldritch were. What had he, Thomas Learmonth, meant? What was the secret of his riddle? He had only minutes before the arguing factions banded together and marched off down the high street in pursuit of their new true Thomas. He needed to be gone. His satchel was packed, his horse ready. Now he heard the crowd approaching down the lane as he'd imagined. They were arguing over what the Eldritch could be.
"Witches! Queer forces! No creature never made by God!"
And someone drunkenly rejoiced,
How can there be creatures never made by God?
Quickly, Thomas cut a portal straight from Ursul Doon back to Fontevraud. In his terror, he had no trouble concentrating on his destination, turning and sealing it up again. And if by some chance it alerted the elven now, so what? Janet was dying. 3. Hod. Janet was dying, and he'd known it instinctively. He could hear the rattling of her breath from across the channel. He sliced open the night and stepped through. In the narrow gate, the imagined slavering Evag warriors failed to materialize. The elven weren't expecting him, did not so much as notice him any longer. Of course they didn't. Probably they thought him dead, long dead. It had been forever since he'd handed Ainsley Remore of Orwich over to the Lusks and brought back Innes. After that, Thomas Lindsay Remore de Ursul Doon had vanished, rightly and truly dead, a living corpse of no concern to anyone, neither elven nor human, because no one alive other than Philip Lusk remembered him, and Philip was long dead now too. They remembered only Thomas of the Ballads, recalled only whimsical sayings that he'd never uttered, while they smeared and coated him with the daub and mortar of True Thomas, obscuring the True Thomas, the Tam of Janet's devotion, the father of Morven, identities long buried, and him nothing but a fading ghost of them, safe from prying elven eyes so long as he lurked in the shadows of this hut, so deep in the forest of Barnsdale that hardly 5 people knew of him, almost never encountered him. Those 5 surely counted him mad, which was an easy disguise, for he was mad, wasn't he? Living forever in the past, where he crossed from Ursul Doon to Fontevraud in 2 terrified strides, and his Janet hovered between life and death, her brown eyes full of love, but mostly pain. He'd had to let her go. Couldn't find a way to rescue her another time. She'd whispered to him that she would meet him in heaven, but he knew now that he would never reach there. Heaven was as far from him today as it had been as he watched the light go out of her eyes. He used to see her eyes so clearly. Now they were just shiny spots in the darkness. He was remembering the memory of them, and soon all of her would be gone. He rolled into a ball on the sack of leaves that was his bed, gnawed on his beard, and ducked his head to hide from his own memories. Except, someone was pushing at his door. Had the Evag found him, finally? Did it matter any more if they did? Who was left to protect? Outside the door, a voice groaned like some awful ghost, and then called softly,
"Woodwolves! Woodwolves! Tell me you're about!"
He squatted there in the dirt and stared as if the words were in some other language than his own. Memories fluttered around the periphery of his awareness. Then came a sigh and,
"Please! Oh, dear Christ, I haven't much time!"
The desperation of it banished the last of the past world where his wife lived on, his daughter too, where he dwelled. He uncurled, lay flat. It was in the hut he'd built, a monk's beehive hut that led most who encountered him to assume he himself must be an ancient monk. His mattress was a wool bag stuffed with leaves. He remembered filling it. He glanced around. There wasn't much to see. Most of his belongings lay in a single chest that had once held Janet's weavings, themselves eaten by moths and so no different than his tattered recollections.
"Please,"
came the appeal once more from outside the door. Why hadn't whoever it was already opened the door? Ah, but he'd thrown the wooden bolt, locking the physical world out. He couldn't recall doing it, but knew he did it quite often. Besides, there was no one else, not even the ghost of Waldrop, who had never yet returned to tease or torment him. Someone was leaning against his door and soughing. Finally, he returned fully to the here and now. To become again the nameless Woodwoes, mad denizen of the forest, he had only to grizzle his long black hair and beard, both grown out so long that he seemed made of hair, and thin his body, making it seem ancient and decrepit. His clothing was hardly more than half-rotted linen braise, but needed no glamouring for a mad hermit. He stood up, spent another moment gathering his wits, then pushed open the creaking door. Into his arms fell Robert Hod. Thomas gently laid the body down on the woolen bedding, ignoring the bow that clattered down as Hod's fingers released it. Hod's hand...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?